Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawane. We begin today's show with a quote from William James, a renowned American philosopher and psychologist of the late 19th century.
Everyone knows the difference between imagining a thing and believing in its existence, between supposing a proposition and acquiescing in its truth.
The words of William James, narrated by British actor Julian Ryan Tutt, in the opening of author Eric Larson's newest work, an audiobook of fiction entitled No One Goes Alone. In real life, James was also a prominent member of the Society for Psychical Research, an organization which explores the potential existence of psychic and paranormal phenomena. And it's in this role that Larson places James into a fanciful and at times dark tale of a group of researchers who set sail in 1905 for an isolated island off the coast of Cornwall in the North Atlantic. Their mission is to investigate a series of inexplicable disappearances on the Isle of Dorne, including that of an entire family who vanished without a trace. The landscape is wild and beautiful and beaten by raging storms. The cottage which housed the family projects an aura of unearthly peace and calm, despite an undercurrent of menace. And there's a cast of intriguing characters who flirt with romance and treachery. Larson is known for his beautifully drawn nonfiction narratives. He last joined us about a year ago to discuss The Splendid and the Vile, and we are happy to have him back with us on Radio Times to talk about his latest work. Hello, Eric.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. How have you been?
I've been great. Thank you.
So let me give out the number for listeners who'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send an email if you like to radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So as the days grow shorter and darker, and we all kind of begin to hunker down ahead of the cold weather, you release a ghost story and a work of fiction, which is a change for you. Tell us more, Eric.
Yeah, so the genesis of this is really actually very strange. It dates back to, I think, about 2006, honestly. That's not to say that this was some sort of like Sistine Chapel work, you know, where I'm on my back for a decade. I mean, it's something that I worked on in bits and pieces over time. What started it was that I was on a book tour for one of my books, Thunderstruck, which was about the intersection of the lives of Marconi and Britain's second most famous murderer, Hawley Harvey Crippen. And it was a good deal of course, had to do with wireless and some of the early thinking about wireless as potentially being the gateway to the afterlife. So I collected all this really sort of funky material about real life, you know, nonfiction material about the late 19th century obsession with ghosts. And the afterlife, you know, the Society for Psychical Research, which really did have a committee on haunted houses. And I loved all that stuff. I could only put some in my book, Thunderstruck. But I had all this other material, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be nice to animate it, to bring it to life as the kind of ghost story that I would like to read. And so in between, you know, hair-raising moments on small aircraft, I would write installments in this story, and did continue to do so really over the next decade and a fraction, just working on it at my leisure with no particular plan, honestly, to publish it. My initial thought was that I'll run this out on my website in installments, like sort of like a modern day Dickens, you know, and have it culminate on some Halloween back in the past. But then, you know, suddenly the publishing industry kind of matured in a way that gave me the ideal vehicle, which is an audio original, yeah. You know, audio only book. So there it is.
Okay, so the story takes place on the fictional Isle of Dorne, which is a day's trip across the water from Cornwall in Great Britain. Describe the Isle of Dorne.
The Isle of Dorne is a relatively small island. It has a single cottage on it. This cottage, I say cottage, but it's in the sort of wealthy late 19th century British version of a cottage. It's quite a large house on this island. The thing that most characterizes the landscape of the island is a cove, which at first glance is an excellent thing because It makes for a very nice harbor for them to dock their boat. Although the cove will soon turn out to have properties that are decidedly not benign. But otherwise, it's if you picture a windswept but very beautiful island in the North Atlantic, there you've got the Isle of Dorne.
And there are eight in the group traveling to the Isle of Dorne, including William James, in real life, well known for his work in philosophy and psychology.
Right.
So he leads this expedition. And as far as the cottage is concerned, which is where this missing family had been staying, there's a certain procedure that has to take place to determine whether a claim of psychical phenomena can be confirmed or debunked. Let's take a listen to a clip from the book, again, as narrated by Julian Reintut.
And what are these for? Laughed Madeline Nash, one of our party. She held up a measuring tape in one hand and a large hammer in the other. Are we going to go about shattering skulls and measuring coffins? William James, our chief in this expedition, smiled. We've been forbidden from doing damage to the house in the course of our investigation, though I should modify the phrase to say obvious damage. One of our first tasks will be to find out if there are any hollow walls or other spaces that could conceal apparatus or, though the idea is far-fetched, unwelcome actors seeking to preserve the cottage's reputation.
Eric, investigations needed to be exhausting because of the potential involvement of charlatans who were around in the late 19th, early 20th century, looking to debunk claims of potential psychic phenomena.
Yeah, and in fact, this is sort of that particular scene and the early action in this novella is really based on an actual event. One of the investigations of the Committee on Haunted Houses that was, as I said, part of the Society for Psychical Research, which, by the way, did about 400 investigations and found no sign of actual ghosts. Hmm. But one of those investigations was in a house. I can't remember whether it was in Wales or England, but it turned out to be that these manifestations were created by a small child who was secreted in the wall. And this, of course, was revealed to be, you know, a complete, you know, fake event. But so I adapted that for the cottage on the Isle of Dorne as a way to get to know our characters in a context of actually doing a scientific investigation, because their goal is to make sure that everything conforms, that there are no voids in the walls, that, you know, if you measure, you know, 6 feet from one end of a room, well, 12 feet from one end of a room to another, and then you have, you know, maybe 13 feet from the outside to the outside of that room, you know, then you're pretty confident that no small child is going to be able to fit inside.
Sure.
But anyway, so this is sort of a vehicle for trying to get into the characters and get into the drudgery, actually, of the kind of really hardcore scientific investigation that these guys engaged in.
Okay, and continue.
I apologize, by the way, for the New York City car horns.
Well, it lends an air of ambiance to the conversation. So continuing to set the stage, Eric, let's take a listen to a clip in which we get a sense of the philosophy with which William James and the Society approach their work.
People report seeing ghosts. That is a fact. But how do we explain these reports and their persistence through time? Can we simply dismiss them out of hand? And if not, how then, as scientists, do we sort and classify them? As I see it, the larger question is, what do these reported phenomena tell us about the nature of the human mind? Clearly, there is something fundamental to our psychological makeup that causes us to experience them, or at least to imagine we've experienced them. While the existence of ghosts has yet to be proven, the existence of a self that needs ghosts to exist, as far as I'm concerned, that has been proven beyond challenge.
So as the character of William James points out in the novel, it was never the Society's goal to declare the existence of an afterlife or the reality of spirit survival. Again, what was the mission?
The mission was to scientifically investigate the possibility of such a thing, and also to debunk those claims that were obviously specious made by others. James was very open in real life to the possibility of an afterlife, if not necessarily ghosts per se. And in fact, went to his death actually believing in the legitimacy of one particular medium who was very well known in the 19th, early 20th century, Lenore Piper, Mrs. Piper, as she was universally known. But so he was clearly open to the prospect, which is sort of the view I have. People ask me, "Well, do you believe in ghosts?" And I'm, no, I don't believe in ghosts, but I'd like to think they exist.
Yeah,
I'd like to think they exist, and I'm open to the possibility. I mean, if somebody can prove, you know, that there are ghosts, I mean, all, you know, more power to them. One thing I don't particularly cotton to is, like, you know, there are so many sort of you know, hokey reality shows, your investigations of the paranormal, where, you know, it's like, come on, you're in a allegedly haunted house. You've got, you know, four or five people who are, you know, the investigators. But hey, never mind. There's also a camera crew, sound crew, and
sure.
Everything else.
It's entertainment.
So no self-respecting ghost is ever going to appear in that place.
Yeah.
But anyway, I do take James's approach, which is, you know, if you know, something can be proven beyond doubt, then I'll accept it. But right now, I just love ghost stories.
So after the break, we're going to get into the story a little bit more. But before we do that, you know, William James helped to found the psychology department at Harvard. I mean, he was a big
yes.
name back in the late 19th century. In researching this character, Eric, what were the challenges in crafting a fictional character out of a real life person?
Oh, you know, I'll tell you, in the case of William James, I honestly did not find it all that challenging, actually. I think in the course of having spent all that time, you know, dipping into the manuscript, pulling out, dipping in, pulling out, an impression of William James had formed in my mind that was really very clear to me, very, very much a concrete person. And so when it came time periodically to write elements of his story into the work, it just came actually really quite easily. I was surprised. You know, I will say this, though, that you know, thinking about nonfiction versus fiction, I do nonfiction, and that's my day job, right? Narrative nonfiction. But what I did find, and once again, I mean, I've taken a crack at fiction in the past and never felt anything was, you know, good enough or worthy to actually publish. But what I found is that I think fiction, I have new admiration for writers of fiction. I think it's a lot tougher to write fiction.
You know what? We're just about up against the break here, so let's hold the thought. We'll continue that after the break. We're speaking with author Eric Larson. His newest work is No One Goes Alone. It is an audiobook. It's a work of fiction, his first. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscawain. Stay with us. More ahead.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscawain has the day off today. Our guest is author Eric Larson. You might know him for his many popular nonfiction works, including The Splendid and the Vile, Dead Wake, The Devil in the White City. He's branched out into fiction with a new audiobook ghost story called No One Goes Alone. And Eric, as we were speaking, as you were telling us going into the break, you have a newfound appreciation for those who craft fiction.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do nonfiction, the story is there. I mean, the thing that happened is your story. And as long as you choose carefully, that does have to work. And the characters are historical characters. You don't have to invent them. Fiction, you have to invent everything, the story, the characters, and you have the challenge of making it actually plausible, because it's a paradox of fiction that if you write something that's unbelievable, even though maybe it was actually a true thing, you're going to lose your audience. Whereas in nonfiction, if something is unbelievable but it actually happened, it just enhances the character of the story.
Yeah.
The other lovely thing that I have to say, the thing that I most exulted in, if you will, in writing fiction was that for once I got to actually write dialogue. You know, for once I got to actually have some fun imagining what people would actually say. Because, you know, I don't do that in my nonfiction books. As I always say in the author notes, author's note at the beginning of my books, that everything between quotes is from an actual historical document, transcript, whatever. But for this, of course, I was able to actually, you know, engage my characters in dialogue and to really have some fun with it. So that was a delight.
So let's get back to the story. Sir Arthur Tembley, a physicist and adventurer, brought his wife and children for a holiday or vacation to the cottage on the Isle of Dorne. They never return home, prompting the investigation by this group of researchers. Things quickly turn chilling. Let's hear another clip from the book in which the character Josiah Frost, who's an expert in the very new technology of the wireless telegraph, has been hurrying with some other characters to join Madeline Nash, a forensic pathologist, and Nicholas Hume, whose father was a famous medium, at the Cove, where they've made an unsettling discovery.
Initially, I could not make out what lay on the beach. What I noticed first was the tenderness with which Madeline moved her hands among the jumble of what appeared to be clothing. As I watched, she pulled apart a seam of cloth to reveal the face, or what remained of a face, of a young boy. Long tendrils of seagrass stretched from his hair almost to the waterline. The tips of his fingers were missing. The upper joint of one finger bore a silver ring set with a smooth oval of lapis. With great care, Madeline removed the ring and placed it in a pocket at the waist of her skirt. "We shall need this," she said. "Whoever lost this boy will want to know his end." "Whoever lost this boy," Winter began through a long exhalation. "Whoever lost this boy lost him a very long time ago."
And they make that determination because the boy's clothes seem to be from the 18th century. So, you know, the question is, who is this child? Will we hear from this child? What will we know of this child? Spiritualism is the belief that humans can communicate with the dead, correct, Eric?
Correct. Yes.
And there seemed to be, there was an increasing interest in spiritualism in the mid-19th century on both sides of the Atlantic. What gave rise to it? I know you referenced this a little bit earlier in the conversation, but what gave rise to this interest?
Yeah, there is a seam of argument, if you will, that holds that it's all Darwin's fault, because Darwin, in postulating a mechanistic theory about how we human beings came to be, you know, the origin of the species, that basically left God out of the bargain, caused a kind of a, if you will, a spiritual rift, sending, let's just say for argument's sake, say half the population deeper into the warm embrace of the church, the other half, like James, off on this very, very sort of scientific, mechanistic direction to try and prove or disprove the existence of the afterlife, and in so doing of other heavenly characters.
Yeah, how did society as a whole in the 19th century view those who believed in and explored the possibility of mental telepathy? I guess we're talking about those who kind of stayed with the church.
Well, first of all, it's not so much mental telepathy that was an element of all this stuff, but yeah. Belief in the afterlife, yes. So you know, it that's the thing that I find so so compelling about this, is that in the late 19th century, and particularly in the late 19th century, and also still lingering, obviously, into the 20th century, why the events in my book take place in 1905. The people who believed in this were among the most sober, credible people of Britain and America. William James was not some flake. He was a deadly serious scientist. And members of the Society for Psychical Research included some of the great physicists of the age, included really some credible journalists. Mark Twain was a member of the Society for Psychical Research, so it was really a respectable thing, and indeed, it actually had many parties. One of the commonplace elements after, you know, after dinner, sort of instead of going out and playing charades and so forth, you know, what people tended to do is they would have a seance, you know, and they even invite mediums and try to reach the dead. I mean, this is what you do, you know, along with your brandy, right? I suppose. and the Ouija board, which wasn't called a Ouija board initially, it was a brand name actually, but
the planchette, is that it?
Yeah, the planchette. Yes, Ouija boards were a common feature of these seances. Ouija boards, by the way, you know, footnote. When I was a kid, scared the hell out of me. Right? These things, you know.
Most of us, yeah.
So anyway, but these people had a lot of credibility. Occasionally, they took things too far, and then there was hell to pay in terms of, you know, criticism and so forth. But you know, things were so. Such credibility, and maybe it's more of a naive and accepting kind of a culture. But there was one event that I write about that you know apparently allegedly really happened, and it's called the Ashley House Levitation.
Hmm.
This was an event where a medium, Daniel Douglas Home, who's the father of an invented character in my story, Nathaniel Home. I would have put Daniel Douglas Home in my story. Unfortunately, he died, and even more unfortunately, he stayed dead. So I wanted to have an element to kind of talk about mediums and so forth. And this is his son, Home, the British pronunciation is Hume, Nathaniel Hume. I wanted Nathaniel Hume in there because he was basically a failure. He seemed to be. He did not have his father's talent, or so it seems. At first,
but anyways,
the Ashley House Levitation involved this medium allegedly rising from the floor, passing out the window, and coming in through another window to return to the room. And those who were at this particular séance swore it happened. They swore it happened.
So was this Daniel Douglas?
What do you make of that?
Hume?
I'm trying to remember if that was Douglas Home or if it was a physicist Cook. I'm blocking on his name. There was a physicist present as well who swore he saw this thing.
And it was never disproved.
And it was never, well, it was accepted as having happened because of those who were there.
Yeah, it makes for a great story. Well, you know, you referenced Twain just a moment ago, and No One Goes Alone, you know, the character of William James describes Twain's experience with a so-called crisis apparition after a party member, a research group member, Catherine Holbrook, asks for a definition. Let's listen.
A crisis apparition, Mrs. Holbrook, is the appearance of a loved one at or near the time of his death in another locale. In Samuel Clemens's case, he and his brother Henry were working the big showboats of the Mississippi River in America's midsection, hoping one day to be captains, which, of course, is when Samuel first learned the expression of depth measure known as Mark Twain, which he later adopted as his nom de plume. Less known, however, is that one night, while he and Henry were staying at his sister's house in St. Louis, Samuel dreamed that Henry had died. It was a vivid image of his brother lying in a coffin held up by two chairs, with a spray of blossoms on his chest, all white, save for one that was red. So vivid was this dream that Samuel awoke in terror and rushed downstairs, fully expecting to see Henry in his coffin. He was sorely relieved to find only an empty parlor. The next day, he and his brother resumed their duties. Their employer assigned Henry to a second steamboat. Samuel remained aboard the first. That night, Henry's boat exploded, a boiler eruption. When Samuel went to see the body one last time, he found Henry just as he had pictured him in his dream, in a coffin supported by two chairs, with a bouquet of white flowers on his chest, a red blossom at the center.
So Eric Larson, Mark Twain apparently did experience a crisis apparition, so he says,
Well, that's what, that's according to his testimony. And interestingly, these crisis apparitions, these, just like ghosts through history, you know, people have reported ghosts since you know, people began to record anything. But these crisis apparitions are also something that has been a common feature of reports through the ages. And it's very compelling to think about these because you wonder if the Society for Psychic Research would have taken the position that these apparitions were likely caused by disturbances in the ether because of the sheer emotional power of someone losing his or her life, someone and someone who is very close to that person being sensitive to that. But these crisis apparitions are a very common thing in the lore of supernatural explorations.
So, and I also didn't know how Samuel Clemens had come about his gnome de plume. Is that?
Steamboats. Yep.
Steamboats. So, Eric, if we listen to or read a work of fiction which contains historical characters, should we safely assume that most everything we see or hear is fictional? How do you want your listener to parse this?
Okay, now that's a very, very interesting question. So this is beyond doubt a work of fiction. But even in even back when I initially conceived it, one way that I sort of overcame my own resistance to doing a work of fiction, to taking myself seriously, if you will, was to think of it as a ghost story with footnotes. It truly was my initial concept that if I was going to, you know, run this out on my website as a treat for my fans, that I was actually going to have footnotes or at least source notes geared to each page, and that continued to be sort of the way I was thinking about it until suddenly, you know, in the last year or so, became this possibility of doing an audio original for the thing came up, and I still intended to do something about. I still thought of it as a ghost story with footnotes, but then I was conversing with my youngest daughter who directs podcasts, and she said, "Well, Dad, you know, it's really hard to narrate footnotes."
Good point.
I was like, "Oh, that's a very good point." So then what I decided is, okay, I was going to have a source essay at the end of the story that would key the events and the real life things that happen that inform the story, so that readers who might be feeling disoriented at that point can see, oh, well, so this was real? That was real? And that part, actually, I narrate.
Well, fun. So with, you know, I just wanted to point out, too, Winston Churchill makes a tiny fictional appearance in this book when he's, you know, with Britain's Home Office. He places a secrecy order on materials documenting the party's search for answers to the right. Isle of Doran. After writing The Splendid and the Vile, did it feel like a little odd or different placing Churchill in a fictional setting?
No, I'm going to stick Churchill in every book. I love Churchill. For all his sins, what a character. But he fit perfectly, though, in this. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing he would have done if he had encountered this sort of documentation, shall we say.
So one more bit from the book. Josiah has been knocking back whiskeys after a disastrous and exceedingly puzzling encounter with his telegraph equipment. So he heads outside, which is not necessarily a good idea.
The creature darted through the grass before me, but was much nearer now. A dark shape, amorphous, without defined limbs, suggesting an animal with a large body but small legs. Again, possum came to mind, but could a possum grow so large and dart about in such a manner? It sprang again, this time toward me, its mass brushing my trousers. I fell headlong and rolled, ending on my back. The fronds of grass closed above me, seeming almost to fuse until just a splinter of night was visible. An instant later, that too disappeared. It was as if I lay in a coffin, watching as the undertaker slid the lid into place.
Eric Larson, how do you craft the shiver that you want to send down a listener's spine?
I think the key is, you know, what I try to write what would make me shiver, you know, the kinds of things. I try to summon up all my nightmares from when I was a child. You know, as the novella is approaching its end, there is a scene where Josiah, who is he's a little diffident at the start of this. But he rises to the occasion toward the end, and he has to go downstairs into the basement and sub cellar to check on his wireless equipment, because he needs the batteries. He needs the batteries for something he's about to do that might save them. So they've already battened this door to the cellar down. They've got planks and anything they can hammered across it, because they had heard something down there. They didn't want this something coming up. And that's sort of the classic setup, that my classic thing that I was terrified of as a kid. So then, you know, Josiah is sent down, and then quickly hammer the other boards in place. So he's down there alone in the pitch dark with his lantern, sort of a sitting duck. And, you know, one thing leads to another. And that's directly based on when I was growing up. I lived in a house in Freeport, Long Island. It was quite a contemporary house for its time. It was quite modern design. And it had a stairwell that went up from the first floor up to the second, where the bedrooms are. And the stairway was open. It had open risers. So conceivably, whatever creature lurked in my living room when I would go down there at night to get a snack and come up in the dark could reach through those slats and grab me by the ankle.
Oh, sure.
this was a persistent terror.
Yeah. I don't think you're alone in that,
19.
Actually. Oh, 19. All right. Well,
no,
listen, we've got a break right ahead. We're going to continue our conversation with Eric Larson in just a minute here on Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscoane. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscoane. Our guest today is author Eric Larson. His newest work is called No One Goes Alone. It's a ghost story, and it's an audiobook. And we've got calls and comments coming in to 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Eric, we've got a question from Bradley, who asks, could you ask Eric if he likes scary movies? And if so, what are some of his favorites?
Yeah, I do like scary movies. Scary to a point, though. When movies sort of seg into sort of grotesque, macabre, you know, bloodshed, even though there's some of that in my novella, when it comes to watching that stuff on the screen, that sort of does get to me. Like there was a movie I saw my daughters took me to for one birthday. It's the film Hereditary, which is really good, really terrifying. But oh my God, that thing haunted me for weeks afterwards. So the answer is yes. I try to qualify it. It's the same thing with books. I try to describe it as this. I like things that are deliciously scary, you know, not that are going to keep me up at night with images of a kid with their head torn off by a lamppost. Yeah. Hereditary again. So
well-crafted, yeah. Scary.
So for example, I love Rosemary's Baby. Just love it.
Yeah. Question from Julie. Is there a difference between a ghost and a spirit?
Well, you're asking the wrong guy. Is there a difference between a ghost and a spirit? I think, I don't know. If I met one or the other, I could be better about telling the difference. You know, to me, a spirit or a ghost, I think they're sort of interchangeable. Certainly Dickens felt that to be the case in his Christmas Carol, which, by the way, is one of the best ghost stories when you get down to it.
Oh yeah, just love it.
He talks about spirits and ghosts and so forth. So I think they're interchangeable.
So William James's brother, Henry James, who wrote obviously some tremendous literature. He also wrote ghost stories. How did he feel about?
He wrote he wrote 18 ghost stories.
18 ghost stories. Okay.
Yeah. See my foot. Take a look at my footnotes.
Did he? What did he think about the Society for Psychical Research? I mean, and its work and its investigations. Do we know?
I actually don't know. My research didn't veer in that direction. All I know is that William James on his deathbed promised his brother Henry that he'd be back and he'd see him again in about 6 months.
And do we know whether Henry saw him again in 6 months?
No, he never. That was an appointment that was not kept.
Okay. All right. A question from David. He says, I love all of Mr. Larson's books, The Devil in the White City, Splendid and the Vile, In the Garden of Beasts. He always uncovers interesting real life stories and people. I'm curious how he finds the stories he tells in his nonfiction.
So you got a couple hours. I wish there were a formula that I could just reveal as to how I go about it. There's always an element of chance, but basically it works out to I'm constantly evaluating potential ideas, and they have to fulfill certain criteria to be viable for me. One is that they have to have a real life central narrative arc, something that in and of itself is suspenseful, is compelling, would keep readers reading as you move along. And oddly enough, there aren't that many. Well, there are zillions of such ideas, but it's hard to find some that especially if you're looking for something that's fresh. So there has to be that natural, central narrative arc or engine. But then there also has to be a deep, deep, deep reservoir of archival materials, because when you're doing this kind of history, especially this kind of narrative nonfiction, you can't make anything up. But you try to get as much detail as possible into the story to make it appear to move like a novel. And I stress appear. I use novelistic techniques in my nonfiction, but it's just the techniques of things like cliffhangers and cutaways and so forth in order to put the reader as deeply as I can into the story. But then the third component is, and probably the most important, is that it has to be something that I feel I can live with for 3 or 4 years. It really is to me. I've often likened it to looking for a spouse. You just really have to think hard about what you want to spend your life doing for the next 3 or 4 years.
So what about tackling contemporary subjects or events? I mean, there's not that deep well of research available. So.
Yeah. Well, I gave up writing about living people when I left. I guess one never really leaves journalism. It's still in my blood. But I pretty much have resolved that I'm only going to write about dead people.
Okay. Fair enough.
They don't. First of all, they don't sue you.
They don't. Can't come back to haunt you, right?
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. I was being unnecessarily glib there, but contemporary issue. I've done two contemporary issue books. My very first books, the first two, and they were a gas for me to do. I mean, I got the bug, right? But one thing I found somewhat daunting is that contemporary books have a very short half-life. Even though they're books, they certainly have a longer half-life than a newspaper article, but they only stay current for so long, and depending on the contemporary subject at hand, they can become quite dated very quickly, especially when new material comes out on the subject, whatever. One of the nice things about doing nonfiction, especially when you have these subjects that have these deep reservoirs of material, is that all the shouting is over. The material is there. You just have to find it.
Sure.
you know, and it's unlikely that you're going to be surprised by some new, you know, FBI witness coming out of the woodwork, you know, doing a deathbed confession. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Oh, we've got calls and comments continuing to come in here, Eric. So let's go to June. She asks, have any of your books been turned into movies or television series? I can imagine many of them making great films or series.
So,
anything optioned?
All of my works of narrative nonfiction, that is all but one have been and are currently under option and are in various stages of development. I've learned over time that when it comes to writers and books and Hollywood and so forth, is that, you know, it either happens with blazing speed, you know, your book comes out and boom, it's a film, right? Or it moves at geologic pace. And I'm apparently in the geologic mode. So anyway, a lot of things are moving along slowly. Devil in the White City, the current concept is that it will be a Hulu limited series, which I love. I love that idea. People had tried, the option remains in the hands of Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. But, over time, people have thought about doing that as, you know, various directors have thrown at time at Devil in the White City, but they've found almost universally that it's hard to make as a single film because it's two stories that run essentially side by side, yeah, barely touching throughout the whole thing. And so the idea of doing this as a Hulu miniseries, Hulu limited series, I just love. I love the idea.
Yeah. Listener Cletus wants to know, what do you think about UFOs and would you do research about that?
What do I think about UFOs? You know, that too falls into the category. You know, when I was a kid, oh my God, UFOs were my thing. I just
really
couldn't wait till I couldn't wait till that first, you know, flying saucer landed in my yard. You know, of course, it never did. UFOs also fall into that same category as something that, you know, I'd love it if they existed. I'd love it if they existed, and I'd love it if somebody could actually prove beyond a doubt. But, you know, once again, the William James stance, it hasn't been proven to me yet.
Sure. All right. Kate asks, have there been great stories in history that you've wanted to tell but have been unable to because they don't have the narrative arc you've talked about?
Yes. I mean, so many. One classic is, you know, is Pompeii. I mean, I'd love to do Pompeii if there were diaries and, you know, so forth. But there's just not. You know, one day there's a, you know, thriving city. The next, everybody's, you know, everybody's a statue of ash and you know, whatever. Yeah. So, or also, you know, I mean, something that has fascinated me, is, you know, Magellan. But again, there too, there's just the paucity of the kind of stuff that really needs.
Question from Dorsey: have you read the ghost stories of M.R. James? It sounds like you might have.
M.R. James, no, refresh me. I
haven't
no.
heard of that person either, but apparently Dorsey has. Thank you for the comment, Dorsey, and thank you for the comments from our previous other listeners. Just a couple more questions about No One Goes Alone, Eric. These characters eat very well, despite the aura of menace that moves about the story. They bring a lot of provisions, and some of the group are quite handy in the kitchen. For instance, the centerpiece of one meal was a gorgeous frittata rustica composed of eggs, smoked ham, mushrooms, at least two cheeses, and a light dusting from a black truffle the size of a child's fist. Are you a foodie?
Yes, I am a foodie. I am a foodie, and I'm a winey. I love wines.
Yes, wine makes an appearance too, quite often.
But even this actually has sort of a historical basis, because, you know, when people traveled, you know, back in the day, you know, they traveled well. I mean, I'm talking about those who could afford the travel and therefore had the money to spend on provisions and so forth. And there is a good deal of grounding to support the idea that these people would have eaten well with foods that for the most part could withstand not being used for a period of time.
Women, the roles of the women in this group are perhaps ahead of their time. You've got Madeline Nash, who's a prominent forensic pathologist. Also, there's a sexual undercurrent running among several of the characters. Josiah Frost is a young man, but perhaps a little uncomfortable with the addition of women, some of whom are quite attractive to the group. Guessing it was still uncommon for the sexes to mix on such an excursion, and also for some of these women to have the careers that they did.
Yeah, well, yeah, I really wanted to play with that because that's part of the story. Part of what happens on the Isle of Dorne is that because they are on this remote island, not only are they investigating something, and actually while they're investigating, they are in turn being investigated by something else. Yes. But there is an opportunity then for people to free themselves from the strictures of Victorian society. And the women, Catherine Holbrook in particular does that, I think, in quite a charming way. And I wanted that in the story because Josiah is basically me when I was just starting to date.
He's kind of awkward, Eric.
Well, hello.
Sorry to say.
I was deeply awkward. You know, my first girlfriend said, would you kiss me? And I said, sure, where? I mean, this was me. And so here's poor Josiah Frost, who's on this island, and he comes to really, really wish that in fact it had just been men. And that's what he had actually expected. But here's this Catherine Holbrook, who has taken quite a liking to him, even though his attentions are initially focused on Madeline Nash, who is more, I guess, to his liking, perhaps because she's so remote. But anyway, yeah, I really wanted to play with those sexual stereotypes and show that in this era, people were starting to branch out. They were starting to break out of the confines of Victorian strictures about sex and so forth.
And again, this is a ghost story. I don't want to give anything away about the aura or forces that move the story along. But care to say, Eric, if it or they are primarily malevolent?
Oh, I think we can definitely say that they are malevolent, even though perhaps at moments they act in ways that perhaps might lead one to think otherwise. For example, the fact that the house initially seems at least to be very unlike any other haunted house in that it's completely without threat, a lovely house, beautiful house. People sleep better in that house than they've ever slept before. Mrs. Beatrice Northrup, who's there to document this for a magazine, has never been more productive. You know, it's that kind of thing. Yeah. And obviously they're being seduced for reasons that are going to become more clear, if not necessarily totally clear.
Yeah. The character of William James at one point references the metaphysical, the eternal battle between good and evil, and the historiography of the Bible. Where did the actual person land on questions of devils and angels and forces for good or evil? Do we know?
William James?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He was a skeptical. He was a mechanistic thinker. He was skeptical of devils and you know, I can't really speak to his views on God. I'd have to pull out one of his papers because I'd want to be absolutely accurate on it. But I would imagine that he approached it in the same way that he approached the quest for the unknown in terms of the afterlife.
Oh, and one quick question before we go, in 30 seconds, Julian Ryan Tutt is the narrator. He's terrific. Tell us quickly about the process of choosing someone to read your words.
Well, you know, the process actually is out of my hands. I mean, I suppose a veto if I disliked, you know, the sound of the person's voice. But in the case of Julian, I mean, he, to me, perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, I was very impressed, and my daughter, the podcast person, feels he's perfect also. So.
Well, that works. And so, listen, it's an audiobook, ghost story. No one goes alone. No one goes alone. Eric Larson's newest work. And Eric, as always, just so, so nice to have you join us. Take care. And
thanks.
Hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Thanks. You too.
Take care. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. Our producer, Debbie Builder. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. Be well.